This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. Spurs go back to the tried and trusted first half bad, second half good. Harry Kane's elite finishing, a goal for Son, and son of Jimmy, Brian Hill, impressing. They're just 2 points off title chasing Newcastle. Meanwhile, it is so tight at the bottom. 5 games for Nathan Jones, 5 defeats. Has he been there too long? As Forest get their first away win of the season. Leeds and West Ham is fun. Leeds score 2 crackers. The point doesn't particularly help either, but we all enjoyed watching it. And poor Leon Bailey, absolutely distraught at missing a late chance at home to Wolves. Also today, the extraordinary story of violence, blackmail, deception and interfering soccer mums in the USMNT. Just what's happening at West Brom? Your questions. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Paul McInnes, welcome.
Hey, Max.
Jonathan Faduba, hello.
Good morning.
And hello, Barry Glendenning.
Hi, Max.
Joe says, will Tottenham's bus parade clash with the late May bank holiday? Sam says, I've been a bit annoyed at how little coverage Crystal Palace have had, both on Football Weekly and the unnamed podcast show. We're always framed as the supporting cast to another team's good or poor form. This week, that lack of coverage is just fine with me. Spurs have done it again, Paul, haven't they? Like, bad first half, should have been behind, weren't, and then actually looked really quite good in the second half.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to know quite why they are as reactive as they are and quite what it would take to, for them to be proactive, and if they were proactive, how good they would be. Because there's a bit of me that wonders whether they could actually ever muster a 90 minutes decent performance. But, you know, when they play like they did... Well, I say they, I mean, Brian, you'll probably talk about Brian Hill, and that is obviously quite an interesting introduction into the Spurs team, and he played very well. But I mean, it's just all about Harry Kane again, isn't it? I mean, 2 goals, a really kind of powerful kind of drive inside from the left to get the third on the go, and then, you know, winning the long ball, flick, you know, elaborating a flick over the top to set Son in for the fourth. I mean, it's all about him, all about his completely rounded game. You know, this guy missed the crucial penalty for England less than a month ago, and he's already over it. He scored 15 goals in 18 appearances. You know, that's going to put him on for over 30 goals in the Premier League, which has only been done, what, twice in the past decade. You know, if it wasn't for Haaland, we'd be going on about, you know, Harry Kane keeps getting better and better. You know, they rely on him awfully, but I think him and Conte are quite simpatico, so I think that might help.
Graham Souness said, I think Spurs will finish in the top four simply because of him. You don't have to play well to win games because you have goals. He is Mr. Goals. Barry, is he who, when if you think of Mr. Goals, is Harry Kane, who is he the player that comes up in your mind? I think maybe sort of more Michael Owen is Mr. Goals to me. I don't know.
I've never really thought about who the personification of Mr. Goals is. Is he would he be like a character in a children's book or a?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. Who do I see? I'm almost thinking Ian Rush.
Yeah.
One for the dads there, but or Mr. Lineker even. I think yeah, Mr. Lineker probably would spring to mind before Harry Kane. But yeah, Harry Kane is undeniably goaltastic. He's now got 198 goals and 300 appearances, and on match of the day, Ian Wright could barely contain his delight that he'd beaten Alan Shearer to tally over the same number of Premier League appearances. Although he did point out that Alan Shearer had missed the best part of 3 seasons with injury, so that was nice of him. But he's incredibly important to Spurs. We know that. It's hardly a revelation. And if he were to suffer an injury that sidelined him for a couple of months, I think they'd be in big trouble because Heung-min Son is not having a good season. He got a goal last night, obviously, and was clearly delighted, but I think that's only his fourth, is it? One hat-trick and that goal. And Spurs are not, well, are they having a good season or not? I don't know. As far as I can tell, they aren't. But their league position and the fact that they're still in the knockout, or they're in the knockout stages of the Champions League, suggests otherwise. But any time I see them, I'm kind of like, wow, they're pretty bad. But yeah, they're chugging along. I'm not so sure they will finish in the top four, but obviously time will tell.
Jonathan, I presume Brian Hill, he feels to me like a footballer you've been watching. I wasn't going to say since he was a small boy, because he still is, but, you know, a younger version of the tiny man that he is now.
Yeah, he played well. He's a decent player. I think obviously he's taken some time to bed into Spurs, and yesterday was arguably one of his best games, to be honest, the way he got between the lines. I thought Crystal Palace, I know the listener doesn't want to speak about them, but I thought they were quite bad. They started the first half they were right and had a few chances, but the sort of the Jordan IU conundrum goes on, starting in the Premier League and kind of not really doing much up front. But I thought Palace just had a lot of players who underperformed. Mark Guehi was really poor, I thought, really weak for one of the goals, and just uncharacteristically kind of bad. And they just seemed a bit weak, Palace, to be honest. I think Kane, the praise I'd give him is that I thought the header he scored, the first goal, was really brave. And I don't know if anyone who saw the Wolves-Manchester United game, but Anthony had three similar chances where he kind of didn't quite fancy putting his head in, you know, getting... There was a chance Kane could get hurt in that challenge, wasn't there? And he kind of... I thought that kind of summed him up in terms of that bravery to, like, commitment to really go for the ball, where there was two or three on Saturday, well, whenever it was. I can't even remember what day is what now in terms of New Year's.
But no one knows.
That day that was the day of the Wolves versus Manchester United game. Anthony had three really good chances like that, where he didn't really want to put his head in the way. The only thing I'd say about Kane is it time for Tottenham to sell him in a few months? Because his contract ends next summer. He's contracted till 2024. So it's almost kind of like now or never for Kane. And I just wonder, like, there's maybe a story to play out there, because if he doesn't leave this summer, then he can obviously leave for free next summer. I wonder if the club hierarchy would allow that. And so I think there'll be some interesting conversations there going on, because Kane obviously has still yet to win a trophy in his long career and might fancy doing that at some point. So, I think there's something to start playing out there in the next few months.
I love the way that it totally decided that he would never ever win it at Spurs there. You speak for, I think, everyone in the world, Jonathan, when you go, he's either got a choice, he's got to stay at Spurs or go somewhere to win a trophy. It's fascinating, actually. You're right.
In fairness to Spurs, he might win a Champions League this season with them, so, you know, then we'd all have egg on our faces.
Yeah, but I'd be surprised.
I will confidently predict that is not going to happen.
What do you reckon, Paul? Like, what should he do?
Yeah, I mean, I think I could see a situation where he lifts the FA Cup at the end of the season, though. But I'm one of these people. I kind of think there's a lot of glory to be had from staying at Spurs and being, you know, their all-time great player. I mean, it's a Shearer situation, and almost exactly, because, you know, if he stays at Spurs, he'll, you know, almost certainly break the Premier League scoring record. He'll be remembered as the iconic player for his club, but he will never have won anything substantial, possibly, with that team. And does anybody look askance at Shearer for that? I'm not sure. If he did move,
but Shearer has a Premier League winner's medal.
Yeah. Okay. But not after his, you know, his big move was to a club where he didn't win anything. Who would he move to if he did? I mean, he's not going to go to City now. The top six is in such flux that beyond City, I'm not sure where your nailed on candidate for kind of improvement is. So then you're looking...
Bayern Munich is talked about a lot, I think.
Do you think Bayern Munich are... I mean, they've got status and he'll win some titles, but it's not quite like... It's not as competitive a division, is it? And, you know, I would have thought he'd be... You know, if he didn't want to set Man City, he'd want Real Madrid, and I don't really know what the Real Madrid situation is. Benzema, you know, him and Benzema aren't that dissimilar in age, 5 years or something in it. It's not like a complete reboot post-Benzema. Would they want him? It's a tricky one,
I
think.
Good question. Yeah. I mean, he's done enough to work the lounges at Spurs when he gets out, isn't he? Like, he can move on if he needs to. On Brian Hill, before we move on from this game, lots of people saying he's just too small and too skinny. And apparently I've mentioned a 12-week physical sort of fitness plan that I was doing. I don't even remember mentioning it on the pod. But last night, two personal trainers, one of whom trained the cast of The Only Way Is Essex, have got in touch to sort of shred me into some sort of Adonis. So maybe Brian Hill can join me to bulk up.
He looks like he should be in the cast of Happy Days or the Brady Bunch.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's the hair. But he was very good last night, but it is difficult to see him ever being anything other than a kind of peripheral fringe player at Tottenham. We know he's not going to get in the side ahead of a fully fit Richarlison or Kulusevski, is he?
No. And fringe is the right word for him.
Well, yes.
Let's go to Ellen Road. Leeds 2, West Ham 2. Paul, not necessarily a brilliant result for either side, but brilliant game.
It was a brilliant game. And it was just, it swung in momentum over the course of the game. It swung in course of minutes. It showed both teams at their sort of best and worst, in that I think there were patches in the second half where West Ham looked like all their, you know, big new boys have sort of clicked, and there was real talent on display, real quality, admittedly only for short periods, but it was there in moments and it looked quite exciting. But the confidence, the mentality is not right, and they sort of dipped in about whether, you know, once they got 2-1, whether a third goal was the good idea or sitting on it was the good idea, and they couldn't really decide. And that let Leeds back into the game, who I thought kind of by and large, Willie Nonto aside, sort of looked a bit short on quality, but couldn't doubt them for their application and determination or their belief. They had belief and they kept going throughout the game, and they've done it enough times this season that they knew there was the possibility of something coming for them, and they went 2-1 down to a great goal from Scamacca, scored a great goal from Rodrigo, and then there were two chances in the last few minutes. Antonio on the stretch of a great cross, which he probably should have reacted to quicker and scored from, and then down the other end a really sweet, really sweet set piece move, I think, that ended up with a Rodrigo header that was incredibly saved by Fabianski. And, you know, so that game could have gone either way. It was harum scarum. There was probably as many moments of error as there were of delight. But still, that's your classic Barclays, I think.
Yeah. It's such a cliche, Jonathan, isn't it, about Leeds being entertaining? But like when they get it right, both their goals were like just really delightful to watch.
Yeah. And I really like Willie Nonto. I think he's going to be a brilliant player. So I think that's something to keep. I think Leeds fans are already really enjoying him. There was something, dare I say it, kind of Yeboah-esque about the goal, like just the way he took it on the left foot, just a bit of a throwback. But he's a really exciting young prospect, did really well at Zurich in Switzerland, and started his career at Inter, and then Leeds have sort of picked him up, and a bit under the radar really, and I think he's going to go on and be potentially a key player for them, and he's quite suited to the Premier League in terms of like physique and also technically. The goals were nice. Leeds are kind of in a bit of a strange situation, really, aren't they? I still feel there's a bit of dissatisfaction from the fans around sort of managerial situation, the ownership situation as well. It seems as though other people upstairs are sort of committed to the club, or they may be looking to move on. I know there's that whole kind of 49ers thing, isn't there, and in the background. And it just seems like there's Leeds fans are a little bit uncertain about where they're going. Still got that maybe post Bielsa hangover. I think Klitsch, obviously the scenes at the end when he kind of got his send off, part of that I felt was maybe kind of the tears for that Bielsa era, really, because he kind of symbolised it, a lot of it, didn't he? But yeah, you know, they played okay in stretches, but Jesse March, it doesn't seem as though the fans are totally convinced by him yet, and performances like from one week to the next are kind of a little bit inconsistent.
Yeah, you mentioned Klitsch, actually. Danny says, please mention his farewell at Elland Road, linchpin of the Bielsa side, absolute steal at $1.5 million 6 years ago, 157 games for Bielsa, 92 consecutive games Missed the 93rd with a hangover from promotion. spray painted a full wall outside Ellen Road. And the fuck off Bob tweet. I don't know if you remember that, Barry, where someone called Bob tweeted to say, stop giving the effing ball away, FFS, and stupid free kicks around the box. It's kid stuff, FFS. To Klitsch replied on Twitter, fuck off Bob. Which, you know, I'm sure so many players have wanted to do that. There are t-shirts for sale. You could buy mugs with it on. And yeah, great servant. I think Jonathan's right about that sort of Bielsa. I don't know. I feel there's a lot of Bielsa vibes around Jesse Marsh, though. It feels like the sort of the, if you're going to replace, if you're going to have a similar type of side, Marsh seems perfect for Leeds.
Yeah, I think if I was a Leeds fan, I'd be happy enough with Marsh. I think he's not that far away from turning them into a consistent side. They're certainly very entertaining. Win or lose, they generally put on a good show. You know, if you were to get rid of him, who are you getting instead? I don't know, but he isn't Marcelo Bielsa, but he's, you know, he very much wears his heart on his sleeve. He is clearly very frustrated with his team's lack of consistency, their inability to win that game last night. I think they were probably the better side. And, you know, that Rodrigo header goes in with the Fabianski save was unbelievable almost. It's a totally different story, but I'd be happy enough to have him as manager if I was a Leeds fan. I like him. I think he's good value. I mean, he is a bit American, isn't he? But you know, and some of the stuff he comes out, he's like a walking little book of calm, even though he's anything but calm. Yeah, I like him.
Yeah, an instance of Jesse Marsh's fury last night, because he's always so furious on the touchline. There was a moment where the linesman or whatever missed the throw-in, called the throw-in wrong, and gave it to West Ham when it should have been Leeds. And Marsh picked up the ball, and he was holding the ball like so furious, just like squatting, holding it up in front of his face. Looked like he was trying to throttle the ball for about 30 seconds. And then eventually just sort of puts it down and lets the play go on. It was like, all right, mate, hope you've worked out your issues.
What do you think will happen to West Ham, Jonathan? It's an impossible question to answer. I mean, in patches, they were, you know, as Paul said, the Scamacca finish was great. The penalty was a no-look penalty, completely ridiculous from Paquetar, but it was a nice finish. And actually, I think good that the referee, even though he didn't sort of mean to play advantage and then give a penalty, it's nice that that is a thing. But the question was none of those things. It was, what's going to happen to West Ham?
I don't think they'll be relegated. So I probably see them in maybe sort of somewhere between 9th to 15th. It's a bit of a mishmash, isn't it? There's about 13 teams in the league this season, but I'm not sure it's really a vintage quality league this year in terms of, I don't know if it's maybe a little bit of fatigue or whatever, but a lot of the teams down the bottom don't seem to really be at the peak of maybe past years. I mean, there is a lot of calls for David Moyes to go, isn't there, from fans at the moment I've seen. The problem with Moyes is that they're sort of buying more and more flair players, aren't they? The likes of Paquetar and, you know, they've got Benrahma there. They've got a lot of sort of nice technical players. And is Moyes the man to kind of get them playing that free-flowing style? I'm not sure. The other issue they have is, you know, it's a bit like the Kane situation, isn't it? Declan Rice pretty clearly making it obvious that he wants to be playing Champions League football as soon as possible during the World Cup. And I think fans, I'm not sure they really enjoyed that statement, to be honest. And, you know, he's their kind of Mark Noble type replacement, isn't he, in terms of that spiritual leader of the club. And for him to sort of say that and pretty much throw his intention, well, make his intentions clear, it just probably adds to the discontent really at West Ham, because I think he was the one that they could really look to and, you know, feel some confidence with. So the season's probably going to peter out for them, and I don't really know where exactly they're going to go. But I don't think they'll go down, because he does know how to organise a defence, which quite a few of the teams down the bottom don't seem to know how to.
Don't forget the Europa Conference League, though. The Europa Conference League, the home of glory. That's, yeah.
Well, a trophy's a trophy. If they get it, it'll be amazing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yesterday was, I suppose, quite a traumatic day for West Ham, because their co-chairman, David Gold, passed away after a short illness. So who knows what effect that will have on any decisions that need to be made in the coming weeks or months.
Yeah, tributes were made before the game. There were flowers on the seat that he would have taken. David Moyes says, "I'm extremely sad to hear this news. On behalf of all the players and my staff at the training ground, I'd like to extend our deepest sympathies to David Gold's family at this very difficult time. Mr. Gold was a regular visitor to Rush Green and always a source of great support and encouragement to myself and the players. It was clear that he had a genuine and sincere love for the club and was a true supporter at heart. He took a great interest in the people working behind the scenes and was always keen to help in any way he could. He will be greatly missed." That'll do for part one. Part two will begin at St Mary's. Hi Pod fans, Football Weekly is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small town Welsh football club has finally been promoted to League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May the 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Southampton 0, Nottingham Forest 1. The side with the worst home record against the team with the worst away record. Box office. Forest won it. First away win, second away goal. Sam says, do we now have the answer to whether Hasenhüttl was any good? Finding it very difficult to write a new version of Tough Job for Nathan Jones, isn't it, Barry?
Yeah. I mean, Philippe thinks Ralf Hasenhüttl is a great manager. I was never convinced, I must confess. But last night, Southampton were pretty pathetic in this game. They had no shots on target. That's their sixth defeat in a row. Nathan Jones really needs a win. Like, really needs a win. Because he's done well at Luton. He's gone to Stoke. That hasn't worked out for him. I don't know if that was a Nathan Jones problem or a Stoke problem. But his record there was dreadful. He goes back to Luton, does brilliantly again. Now he's got this step up to the Premier League and couldn't really have got off to a worse start. It's an underwhelming appointment. I think Southampton fans weren't particularly thrilled by it. And they made their feelings abundantly clear at the end of the game last night. They were booed off quite emphatically. And I wondered, is there a part of the Southampton hierarchy that think they might have already made a mistake in appointing a manager with no Premier League experience? I have no idea. But he desperately needs a win.
Southampton's next game is against Everton, Paul, which is hilariously big, isn't it?
Couldn't think of teams on worse form either. So it might actually work out that Saints do get a win. But I'm not sure that will change the complexion for things all that much. I mean, reading the comments under the Guardian match report last night, which is always quite good when it's sort of teams who aren't right at the top of the Premier League, because you do get a lot of hard-boiled fans posting there. And there was just a widespread fatalism, really, that yes, Jones should never have been appointed. He's going to barely touch the sides. But this has been a moment a long time coming, and that there's a kind of a sense of gravity for any team that doesn't have, you know, billions behind them. And even when you do have the billions, that can run out at any point. But there's a sense of gravity that pertains on all but the kind of the most elite of the elite clubs. And eventually your spell in the Premier League will come to an end. And the fans were very much giving off that vibe. And you can't really see beyond, you know, James Ward-Prowse. You can't really see any kind of leaders in that team who could make a positive difference for them to turn it around, because, you know, their transfer spending in the summer was just on callow players, you know, talented players, but players with no experience. And somebody like Che Adams is, you know, all right and probably could be more effective than he is, but he's not the sort of person who looks like he can go on a half a dozen, you know, six goals in six game streak, start turning things around. So where does it come from? Personally speaking, you know, I think you get rid of Jones now and you try and go for Sean Dyche. I mean, they obviously didn't want Sean Dyche earlier because they wanted to play a progressive brand of football or whatever it was, or, you know, something more systems-based. But I think if you want to stay in the Premier League, there is an option there that is probably better than the one you've got.
That's quite a nuclear option, though, to get rid of him. What's he had? 3-4 games in charge?
Lost five in a row. Yeah.
I mean, I think he reminds me. You know, he's a Pepe Mel kind of, or a Kike Sanchez Flores version two. You know, there are some managers you come in, barely make an impression, and then, you know, go again, and you don't remember him 6 months later. And if the gamble works, then everybody can move on. I mean, I think, haven't Saints done it before that Mark Hughes season? Wasn't he quite a late drop in to kind of save him? So I kind of feel like I don't see it going any other way than down for Saints at the minute. And it depends on how long term the thinking is at Southampton. And I'm not sure it is that long term.
Yeah. Do you know what? I don't know what you think, Jonathan. I would feel so bad for Nathan Jones. I mean, I'd get over it, it would affect my life in a big way, but I think Paul might be onto something there. I think that might be a good idea. You could see Dyche getting anyone out of that. I mean, I think Everton could be thinking the same thing, you know?
The problem they have if they go for someone like Sean Dyche is that they've got new ownership, haven't they? And they've kind of come out and said they want to have this new model and kind of announced this brave new world that they're going to go, this route that they're going to go down. And I think they hired someone, I believe, from Brentford. I might be wrong on that, but, you know, maybe looking towards that kind of recruitment style. And I think Nathan Jones was going to be the man to kind of lead that and maybe start to bring in his own players and work under that model. They've gone for a lot of, you know, youth recruitment in the summer, you know, the likes of Edozie, for example, from Manchester City, who's sort of had a lot of game time. And if you do that and then you sort of get rid of it and then you go for Sean Dyche, it's almost like, would you then get rid of Sean Dyche at the end of the season, or would it be a contract to the end of the season, if you know what I mean? And what does that do for his reputation? You know what I mean? He probably doesn't want that.
Is he the new Allardyce? Yeah. Is what he is.
He might, you know, that's exactly it, yeah. Isn't it? He's going to maybe look at it and be like, do I want that reputation as that sort of firefighter? So
might get the new Allardyce when you could get the old Allardyce. I just started thinking that's what we all, the Premier League needs it, doesn't it? On the flip side, Nottingham Forest, first away win. I think it's the first time they've, you know, pick the same side, Barry, two games running all season. So perhaps he's starting to sort of, Steve Cooper's starting to get, you know, a modicum of an idea of who his side is. And also, like, you saw his celebrations at the end with the fans. What Southampton and Nathan Jones don't have, that relationship that Steve Cooper has earned from the Forest fans, and they are sort of all in it together, which I think makes a bit of a difference.
Well, it's obviously their first season back after a very long time out of the top flight. They're enjoying the adventure. They are on a slight upward trajectory. This is a massive win, albeit against pretty pitiful opposition. But, you know, to win... Was that the first goal they've scored away from home? Second away goal. So, yeah, it's a brilliant evening for them and a great result for Steve Cooper. But, you know, you're comparing apples and oranges because Southampton have been in the Premier League for a long time. They're very much on a downward trajectory. I think in our pre-season pod, I thought I was going to be unique in predicting a Southampton relegation, and lo and behold, every single person agreed with me. So it's no great surprise to see them in this position. But when you make those pre-season predictions, you can only judge clubs in the situation they're in at the moment. So they might start badly, replace the manager, and then hugely improve. But Southampton started badly, have replaced their manager, and if anything, seem to have got worse. So it's difficult to see how they get themselves out of this pickle now. And I agree that it's I feel bad suggesting that Nathan Jones is a wrong appointment after just five games. But he may very well turn out to know exactly what he's doing, given time, and in another five games, it could be a completely different picture.
Just on Forest, I kind of feel that you know, the it's a really interesting case right now, because if really you kind of think if there hadn't have been those rumours of Cooper getting the sack, you know, what, in October, then they might have never been in the position to be kind of turning things around, because the fans rallied behind Cooper in a way that, you know, is quite unusual in Premier League's circumstances, that when things are going badly, rather, fans are usually kind of like, well, yeah, they could get worse. But these guys were like, no, we respect what he's done. We like him. We want him to stay. We acknowledge that he's in a bind with having to deal, you know, integrate 127 new signings. But that gave him the space. When they went and gave him the contract extension, that was all of a sudden the kind of the balance of power had shifted. And he then got the breathing space to actually go, well, which of these players actually work for me? And which of the, you know, how can I build a unit that works out of these guys? And I think, you know, the front three, he obviously wanted Gibbs White more than, you know, pretty much any other signing. He's kept with Brennan Johnson. Irony is looking like, you know, the leading man that can anchor that all around. And it's starting to take shape. But he got that breathing time because of a rare situation where the fans were like, no, it would be wrong to sack him right now, which you don't get the feeling that somebody like Nathan Jones would get.
Hmm. Yeah, the same manager bounce is what they got, yeah. Forrest, yeah. Isn't it? It is Forrest's first away win since 1999, which would be a meaningful stat if they'd been in the Premier League since 1999. Stourbridge Tricky says, have you heard about the skateboard and Rubik's Cube king from Brazil, Gus Scarpa? Got a great left foot as well. He's going to be a cult hero at Forrest. He is arriving in January from Palmeiras, has a skateboarding hobby and has been scouting places in Nottingham. He said, an indoor park, I already found one in Nottingham. Now an outdoor park on the street will be a little difficult because of the weather. It rains practically every day, but we adapt, we dig. I'm a guy who looks too much for things I like to do, that I want to do, but there's still a Rubik's Cube, drums, a lot of things I can do to occupy myself there. So if you see a man doing a Rubik's Cube in a skate park in Nottingham, that is Gus Scarpa.
I don't know if Forrest have played at Crystal Palace yet this season, but when they do, if that is still in the calendar, I would like to cordially invite Mr. Scarpa to come to the skateboard at the end, or skateboard park at the end of my street, which has just been relaid and redesigned, and is, I believe, acknowledged as the best skate park in the United Kingdom, if not Europe. Wow. I just wonder. Is there a clause in his contract? Is he allowed to skateboard? Because it's quite dangerous.
Yeah. Yeah. We haven't talked about Manuel Neuer breaking his leg skiing, have we? After the World Cup, which sort of seems extraordinary that you'd go, you know, surely like Bayern are a bit like, I'm not sure you should have been doing a blue run, Manuel.
It's like the time Carlo Codocini, didn't he break his leg or arms on his motorcycle, and it turned out he shouldn't have been on a motorcycle because his insurance didn't cover it. But anyway, yeah, the invitation stands if Scarpa wants to come and try out Brixton Skate Park.
In this game as well, Bhupinder Singh Gill became the first Sikh Punjabi to serve as an assistant referee at a Premier League match. My dream has always been to reach the top of the game, be a role model for future officials, encourage more people from diverse backgrounds into officiating, especially from a South Asian background just like me, he said. The other assistant also had a lovely moment. After the goal, the camera panned to the bench and he was right in the front of picture and he evacuated both nostrils with gusto. So good for him. Villa 1, Wolves 1. Leon Bailey, Jonathan, had an amazing chance to win it in injury time. Round the keeper and missed. But he was absolutely devastated. It was like what happens if he misses a chance in a game like of real significance? Not like what if he gets to a cup final? I worry for him.
Yeah, I'm worried for him as well. It's strange, like, what prompts a professional to react in that way in a sort of relatively minor sort of insignificant match, really. Put out on, well, not insignificant, but you know what I mean? It's not like a sort of cup final or, you know. He put out on Instagram as well, didn't he? Like, I'll be up all night. I won't sleep for days and sort of, you know, just like, I don't know if it's maybe he feels like he's not performing that well at the club, and maybe that pressure has made him feel like he really wants to step up or just puts high standards on himself, because I'm sure he's missed other chances and been pretty blasé about it. So, yes, it is a weird one. It almost felt as if it was for show at first, but then he did seem genuinely sort of devastated, didn't he? So it's I don't think I've seen that before, really.
But it was like he was playing a role. It was like, you know, it was like a scene in Neighbours where, like, somebody walks to the lake and their partner is drowned and they're just sort of sobbing uncontrollably. Look, it's good to show emotion, I guess. We shouldn't knock that he cares. Emery afterwards, Paul, said, look, you know, it's good because it shows he cares. But like, someone needs to say, look, it'll be the difference between finishing 12th and finishing 12th, probably.
But the thing is though, Max, like, you know, fans always sort of accuse players of like, oh, well, does he care about the club and he's not playing for the shirt? So it's almost like you can't have it both ways, you know what I mean? Either you accuse them of not caring, or you can't then accuse them of caring too much, because that was like an extreme case of caring.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Daniel Podence's goal was so lovely, wasn't it, Paul? You sort of forget that all Premier League players are brilliant. That's what I thought when I saw that goal. I was like, you know, I paid no attention to Daniel Podence, but look at his balance and grace and all those things.
Yeah, no, it's true. I think I've seen sort of, there seems to be a lot of good play in and around the box, people kind of creating space to score. Nowadays, there's a lot more that kind of goal, and that perhaps wasn't the best I've seen, but taken on a pace, and he finished really well. Wolves in that first half were, you know, really impressive all around, and you kind of reminded that actually a lot of that people talk about the kind of the signings that haven't worked for them. I'm trying to think of that £35 million teenager who's barely play for them up front.
Fabio Silva.
Yeah, Fabio Silva. You know, people, you know, you think about Fabio Silva and you think of their bad signings, but actually a lot of their recruitment has been really good. And that midfield three of Moutinho, Neves and Nunes, you know, really dominated the game against Villa, and surprised the home team. I think, I don't think they expected such resistance and such a technical ability on the ball as well. They really drove the game, and there were lots of forward passing, breaking the lines quite readily. It was impressive to watch. You know, this being a sort of West Midlands Spanish derby, though, it was, you know, you knew it wasn't going to be over and that Emery would have its say, and he tweaked things, bringing on a new left back, Augustinsson, who kind of offered a very different kind of option on that left, which kind of changed the dynamic for just in a tiny way, but for Villa, and bringing on Ings obviously changed that shape and changed the questions that we're asking of Wolves, and eventually they deserve their draw. I thought it was an interesting game, both managers showing that they're going to bring something to the Premier League. I thought,
yeah, a great goal line clearance from Max Kilman from Ludvig Augustinsson, who I confess I'd not heard of until he hit that volley, and Ait Nouri's run at the end had no right to get through about a million people and get a shot away, but probably a fair result, Barry.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I mean, I did enjoy at the start, Emiliano Martinez was back in goal for Villa after returning from the World Cup, and he came out before the game with his World Cup medal and his golden glove, and was like, oh,
come on, mate, do it.
But I think he managed to rein himself in. That's just one thing I wanted to pick up on. It's not really pertinent to last night's game, but I think it was on TalkSport yesterday. There was an interview with Adama Traore in which whoever was interviewing was asking him about his weightlifting regime, and he insisted that he does not do weights. He doesn't pump iron. And I'm just going, that can't be possible. How is he the physique he is without lifting weights? It can't be true.
He needs to speak to Brian Hill.
Is it all body weight? What's Adama doing? I mean, maybe he'll email, maybe these personal trainers could email us and tell us. But I would imagine he spends some time in the gym, but maybe he's just too humble.
But I mean, if any personal trainers out there can get me a physique like Adama Traore's without having to endure the tedium of pumping iron, I would love to hear from them.
I don't think you'd be the same Barry if you looked like that, to be honest. Oiling yourself up before a pod. Chelsea Man City tonight. Before we end part two, we're going to talk about the Greg Berhalter story from the US, which is quite extraordinary. Lots of our US listeners getting in touch with this. It all stems from Gio Reyna not being picked much at the World Cup. You might remember that USMNT manager Greg Berhalter had told him he wouldn't get a lot of game time. He reacted badly, and so he got less game time, and this came out publicly. As a result, turns out that Gio's parents, Claudio Reyna and Danielle, his mum, well, Danielle told US soccer sporting director Ernie Stewart about Berhalter physically assaulting his wife, Rosalind, when they were going out in 1991 when they were teenagers. Quote, I told Ernie that I thought it was especially unfair that Gio, who had apologised for acting immaturely about his playing time, was still being dragged through the mud when Greg had asked for and received forgiveness for doing something so much worse at the same age. Bahadur is now under investigation by US Soccer. After admitting the allegation, in a statement on Tuesday, Berhalter said he had been contacted during the World Cup by someone saying they were going to, quote, take him down. There are zero excuses for my action that night, he said. We had been dating for 4 months when an incident happened between us that would shape our future relationship. One night while out drinking at a local bar, Rosalind and I had a heated argument that continued outside. It became physical and I kicked it in the legs. That statement was co-signed by his wife. I think it's impossible to separate the offence, which is disgraceful, and the rest of the story. Like, domestic violence is a real problem in society, in football. We've talked about it before, and it doesn't matter if it was last week or if it was 30 years ago, and there is clearly no time limit on when you can report these things. But correct me if I'm wrong, Barry, is this scenario a bit like you knowing, your mum knowing something about me, and you, and her going to the bosses at The Guardian because I'm somehow sidelining you by only asking you dumb open goal questions or something? Like, I don't like taking aside the seriousness of the incident, which I don't want to do, but like, is that the same? That feels what it is like to me. I don't know, what is Gio Reyna thinking in this situation?
I don't know. It's a very weird story, and it seems to show how insular the world of American soccer is, because all the men involved, like Claudio Reyna, Ernie Stewart, Greg Berhalter, they're all in the USA 94 World Cup squad. I keep expecting Tab Ramos or Tony Miola to pop up and chip in with some sort of contribution. We were discussing this before the pod, and Paul made the point that, you know, what Greg Berhalter did to his wife is inexcusable. Daniela Reyna has suggested that there was more to it than they've admitted in their statement. I don't know if that's true or not, obviously, but her and Berhalter's wife were friends. They were in college together. They were roommates for 4 years. They played football together. And yeah, anyway, so Paul said, look, what he did was inexcusable, but he apologized. The woman who is now his wife accepted his apology. They got married, they've had children, they've been married for 25 years. I really don't understand what Claudio and Daniela Reyna, who apparently are, well, presumably not anymore, but were very good friends with Berhalter and his wife, are trying to achieve by this. You know, obviously mums stick up for their sons. They don't like to see them get dragged. But if it was my mum, I'd certainly be asking her to pipe down and, you know, please don't make an already unpleasant situation way worse. Now, the thing to remember is Berhalter is out of contract. His contract expired on the 31st of December. And I think until this happened, it was a question of when he would sign a new contract and he would lead the USA into the next World Cup, which, of course, is a home World Cup for them. But will he be punished for this assault he perpetrated, whatever, 30 years ago or 26 years ago? I don't know. Should he be punished? I don't know either. What he did is obviously not cool.
On Tuesday, US Soccer released a statement saying, upon learning of the allegation against US men's national team head coach Greg Berhalter on December the 11th, US Soccer immediately hired Alston and Bird LLP to conduct an independent investigation into the matter. We appreciate Greg and Rosalind coming forward to speak openly about this incident. Consistent with our commitment to transparency, we'll share the results of the investigation publicly when it is complete. US Soccer condemns violence of any kind and takes such allegations very seriously. And that'll do for part two. Part three, we will be joined by Alistair Jones from Action for Albion to discuss what's happening at West Brom. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's bring in Alistair Jones from Action for Albion. We were just discussing in the break there. Lots of people keep getting in touch saying, can you please discuss what's happening at West Bromwich Albion? And Barry and I I don't want to speak for Paul or Jonathan, but Barry and I have absolutely no idea what's happening at West Bromwich Albion. So hopefully you can shed some light on it, because like, you're doing well on the pitch, but situations off the pitch are not right. Is that correct?
Absolutely. I mean, it's we weren't doing well on the pitch either. I mean, it was a disastrous start to the season under Steve Bruce. And we'd taken on Carlos Corberan 8 weeks ago. So I don't know whether it's Carlos Corberan or Action for Albion's initiation that has caused this upturn in form. But since Action for Albion's come on, we've won 8 out of 9 and we just have no idea where it's come from. We were bottom of the league. And now we're a point off the playoffs and we're really challenging. But as I say, it could be a special season on the pitch. And it's such a shame that the club is fractured as it is. And it looks like we've got huge off the field ramifications along with the on the field improvements that we've made.
So give us an idea of like who owns West Brom and what, and they own money. Is that right?
Yeah, okay. So in 2016, Jeremy Peace, who was our previous owner, sold to a consortium and a majority shareholder, 88%, and I'll come on to that in a minute because that's quite an important part, 88% of the business to Guochan Lai, who is a Chinese gentleman and business owner based in, obviously, in Guangzhou, I think he's based in. And the idea was that we're going to complete a self-sustained business model, and the business would be a self-sustained business model. So in fairness to the incumbent owners, they never said that they were going to spend millions and millions of pounds. They said they were going to be a self-sustaining business model. And that went quite well for the first few years. As you probably remember, we were in the Premier League and we had 8 successful Premier League years. And then we had one disastrous year where I'm sure you remember Taxigate in Barcelona, where the lads had nicked a taxi and it was all a disastrous start. Tony Pulis started with us in that season and then Alan Pardew took over, which was unmitigated disaster, as tends to happen with Alan Pardew nowadays. And then after that, they went to Barcelona on a warm weather training trip and ended up stealing a taxi and running off with the taxi. Do you remember that?
Yes, that's right. I remember now, yeah.
Yeah. So essentially, that season we got relegated. Now, at that time, we were in the top 10 spenders in Europe at West Brom, and we were the 11th highest wage bill. And obviously, that doesn't necessitate to a self-sustaining business model. So when they cut the cables off to be able to spend some money, unfortunately, went badly wrong. And so since then, we've had some major issues. And then what really brought it to light was last year's accounts. It came to fruit that had a £5 million loan to a company called Wisdom Smart that they'd taken out of the football club to lend to another one of Guochan Lai's companies that were struggling during the pandemic. And then we had in the account, it said, well, don't worry about that. It was March 2021. We're not going to pay that back. We haven't paid it back yet, but we promise you by December the 31st, we'll pay back. Now, on top of that, there is also another loan, which was inherited by Guochan Lai from the previous owners, that took 18 months for a forensic accountant to find. And that totals around about 4.7 million. So we're up to 9.7 million that has been taken out of the club that's not been put back. And then just to put a cherry on a really poor cake, there was then another £2 million share dividend that was basically written out to say, we're going to sell shares for £2 million. And those £2 million went to Guochan Lai. And so that's another £2 million. So in total that we know about, and that's important that I stress that we know about, £12 million has been taken out from the business. And that isn't hearsay or tittle-tattle. That's actually fundamentally in the accounts that's proven that is what is owed to the football club that has not been paid back.
Action for Albion, presumably they're asking the chairman of West Bromwich Albion to stop taking money out of the club and putting it into other things and give it back. Seems quite a sensible thing to ask for.
That'd be quite nice. I mean, look, the one thing that we've tried to do as Action for Albion, we're not an angry mob, we're reasonable people, and we want answers. We've actually sent an open email to Ron Gourlay, who's the CEO of our football club, and I feel a little bit of sympathy for Ron Gourlay, actually, to be honest. I mean, he didn't know any of this when he took over the club. The communications has been abysmal, but that's by the by. He actually, I think he's been let down himself by being told that this money was going to be paid back. So Action for Albion set up about being legal, above board and reasonable in everything that we do. So every protest that we've made, which I'm sure you'll ask me about what protests we're doing at the minute, we will always be peaceful and we want to have a dialogue with a football club that we all love.
Alistair, 12 million quid's obviously a lot of money, but in football terms, it's not a huge amount, particularly for a club that's been in the Premier League for a long time. Is there a concern that the club might be in far more financial peril than this, and I use the term advisedly, relatively paltry amount suggests?
Yeah, thanks for that question, Barry, because it's really, really important that I put across. So, yes, there is a consideration that we're in trouble, and it's been proven this week because on top of what they owe, they've actually taken out from MSD, which seems to be the football equivalent of Wonga. When anybody needs like a loan in football, it seems to be MSD, Southampton done it, and then more scarily, Derby have done it. We've had to borrow £20 million this week at around about 10.7% interest to continue day-to-day running of the football club. So when you ask that question, the question remains, and the questions that we want asking is, how can a club with 20 years of consecutive Premier League money, because that's West Brom, since 2002, we have had 20 years of consecutive money in the Premier League, how in the world, whether that be by parachute payments or participation, how in the world have we got to a point where the 1 year that we might not get promoted, that we've got to borrow £20 million to continue in the day-to-day run of the football club?
What's the communication like between you and the club? Like, are they being... you start laughing already. So I won't ask a follow-up.
We put an open email, a very polite, and I'll happily forward it on to you guys so you can see. We put a very polite email to Ron Gourlay asking just for a sit-down and a cup of tea, just to sit down and talk to us. At the end of the day, they're custodians of the football club, but the football club, it belongs to the fans. And to have absolutely no communication whatsoever. In fact, a small win, I think, for Action for Albion was that they put a four-line statement out saying that their money wasn't going to be paid back on New Year's Eve. Happy New Year, guys. You're not getting the money back, by the way. But at least we think our work has put that on. We're absolutely confident that that would never have even gone out onto the website if we hadn't have done what we've done over the last 8 weeks.
Yeah, and actually, and the wider issue is, isn't it, it's... And we've talked about this with reference to other clubs and other owners and clubs that have gone out of business and others that have just survived. Is it, you know, until it's your club, you just sort of think, you know, we're all in this football family, in inverted commas, but actually you just go, oh, thank God that's not us. But it could be any club. And actually, it's interesting. I saw a thread from Gordon Brown about an independent regulator, right? Which it just, stories like this scream that we need that in football.
I couldn't agree more. I've been on your channel, actually, TalkSport, last week with Addy and Scott Minto, and I said exactly the same. The governance in football is absolutely vital. If you go through up and down the football pyramid now, there's many of these. We're not the only ones. There's a huge amount, and there's something fundamentally wrong in the way that football's set up in this country, and that has to change. The fit and proper persons, whatever you want it to be, the governance in football is wrong because there's too many stories like we've had over the last 2 or 3 years. It can't just be unlucky. It's got to be something that's wrong in the setup of the whole of football.
Look, Alistair, thanks so much for coming on. We really appreciate it. Stay positive, you know, and at least it's going well on the pitch. You know, you never know.
Can I just mention very quickly just what we've done just regards to protests and things like that, because it's been important that we show. We're trying to be a little bit different. You've probably seen it's a bit like a Coldplay concert when we score goals, and it's actually happened that we've scored goals around we've done the 12th minute of the second half, we've done a shine a light protest. So we find that, and we've done a lot of work with this, that the more easy the protest is for people to participate in, the more people do. So everyone's got a mobile phone. So when on the 12th minute of the game of the second half, when it's dark, because it makes it look better, we ask our guys to shine a light. So when you see on the telly that loads of lights shine at the Albion, that's based on shining a light on the situation at Albion and maybe football as a whole. And there'll be other protests, but they'll always be peaceful. And that's just, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to come on and showcase what we've got wrong with the football club. I really appreciate it.
Good man, Alistair. Thanks so much for your time, mate. We'll keep in touch.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Cheers, guys.
Alistair Jones there from Action for Albion. A club statement said that Lye had assured the club's board that the money would be repaid, quote, early in the new year. Chief Executive Ron Gourlay has assured fans on the 23rd of December the loan would be repaid in time to be used by the Baggies in the transfer window in January. Elsewhere in the EFL, Carl says, at what point does Darren Ferguson get allocated a permanent parking space in the Peterborough United car park? It's his fourth stint as Peterborough manager, replacing Grant McCann, And that was his third go in charge. So they're just alternating Grant McCann and Darren Ferguson. But, you know, they're not far off the playoffs in League One. I hope they don't go up. And on the subject of cars, Barry, have you seen Dan Byrne's car? I mean, it can't be real. And if it is, it's absolutely sensational. I don't know what make of car it is.
Well, it's some sort of smart car, isn't it?
So how does he fit in that? It's tiny.
Well, we were discussing, me and a couple of mates were discussing this the other night, and my friend Jonathan, I don't think you've met him, you've met his dog Norman, but he's 6 foot four, mm-hmm. and he said when he first passed his driving test, he drove a smart car, and he was able to fit in it quite comfortably. They're quite roomy, because there's no back seat, you know.
Right, so. Okay. Well, good for him for not driving a Porsche. It's like Jürgen Klinsmann and his Beetle. Dan Byrne keeps his feet, his big feet, firmly on the ground. Thank you to Magic Mikey, who sent me that picture of Dan Byrne's tiny car. And that'll do for today's pod. We'll do the FA Cup third round this weekend, so we'll talk about that on Monday. But for the time being, the phone goes and it's time to leave. That is what that sign is. Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you very much. That was my phone.
Good. Well, get it. You're free to go. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
And thank you, Barry.
Thanks, Max.
Football Weekly was produced by Joel Grove. Our executive producer is Max Sarnas.
This is The Guardian.